CKUT.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Hey everyone, it's Sam.
And David.
I hope everything is going well on your end. On our end, where David and I live, there is an incredibly important Indigenous-led uprising happening here and across all of so-called Canada.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think either of us have seen anything on this scale happen before in our lifetimes.
Not at all. This is so incredibly inspiring and exciting right now.
Yeah, and so we're going to go straight into the interview. But before doing that, I just want to urge everybody listening who isn't already familiar with the struggle to learn more. Follow the links in the show notes. And if you are familiar with the struggle, to get involved wherever you live, answering the call for solidarity that's gone out.
So just to recap for folks who weren't paying attention, familiarize yourself with the struggle and get involved.
And here's the interview.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, it's the Montreal folks again.
Hey. Okay, just one sec. I'm just going to go into my truck.
Okay.
All right, can you hear me all right?
Yeah, it sounds really good.
And yeah, so the other last thing before we get rolling is just we normally start the show by inviting our guests to introduce themselves. And like some people are like,
okay,
my name's Sam and I love cats. And then other people give us a whole long description of who they are. So it's totally up to you.
The format's just saying your name and then a bit about yourself.
Yeah.
Okay.
So whenever you're ready, we can just start if you feel comfortable with that.
Sure. Jennifer Wickham hit me. Gidimden is then. My name is Jennifer Wickham. I'm a Gidimden member of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. I come from Cassia, which is the grizzly bear house, and I am the media coordinator for the Gidimden camp.
Well, thank you so much for taking this time to talk with us. I can only imagine how busy you are right now and how many media requests you're getting, so we're really appreciative that you're talking with us today. And so I was hoping we can just start by talking a bit about the history of both the Unist'ot'en and Gidimden camps. You know, how did they first come to be?
Well, Unist'ot'en has been occupying their traditional territories for about 10 years. And it was the women of the clan, so Frida Hewson, I'm sure people are familiar, she is the spokesperson for the Unist'ot'en. Her and some of her family members were really inspired by her grandmother to go back out and occupy their territory. So the Unist'ot'en, over the last 10 years, have built a home out there. They now have a healing center where they do traditional land-based healing with community members, and it's really grown exponentially in the last few years. And it was in 2018 that Frida and her partner at the time, Smoke Okem Warner, were served with an injunction notice from Coastal GasLink, and they were named as the two defendants, as well as Jane Doe and John Doe. That happened December 14th, 2018. And immediately after that, the Gidimden clan had a meeting and decided to stand in solidarity with the Unist'ot'en. So each house group has territory that they're responsible for. And the Unist'ot'en territory right across the river is Gidimden territory. And that territory belongs to Cassia, which is the house that I belong to. And so we decided that in order to stand up for our relatives, that we would start our own camp, the Gidimden camp, at 44 kilometer, which is where there's a junction in the road where you turn off to go up to Unist'ot'en. And we ended up having a smoke feast, which is a part of our traditional hereditary governance system, as a way to announce business taking place. And all the clans in the feast hall stood up to support us in our decision to go and defend the Unist'ot'en and to stand in solidarity with them. And so by December 17th, we had a couple of army tents. We went out and we started our Get 'Em Done camp at 44 kilometer. And we haven't backed down from that position. The Unist'ot'en, for a really long time, were the only ones out on the territory. My sister, Slato, Molly Wickham, and her family moved out to our territory to live out on the land in 2014. And so this project really impacts people's daily lives. So it's not an issue of, you know, we want to go fishing out on the river or some sort of leisurely activity. There are people that are actually living out on the territory and depend on the territory for their life. So everything that they eat is harvested from the territory. All their moose meat, their fish, their berries, their medicines. And that's also incorporated in the Healing Center land-based programming, is accessing all of the territory for the people that are out there. And something people might be more familiar with is the raid that happened on Get 'Em Done Camp on January 7th, 2019, where our people were forcibly removed from our territory. And we later learned that the RCMP had approved lethal overwatch. So they had snipers. They had the tactical teams carrying assault rifles. They had expanded their interim injunction to include the Get 'Em Done camp, because previously it had only included the Unist'ot'en territory. They established their CISO, which is the Community Industry Safety Office, at 29 kilometer. Since then, we've been under surveillance of the RCMP, and there's daily harassment that continues.
And have there been conflicts like this before the Coastal GasLink pipeline that have come up?
Yeah, so there have been several proposed pipeline projects that have wanted to drill underneath the headwaters. So the river there we call Widzinkwa, which is the main salmon spawning river for the entire territory. And yeah, so the big one was the Enbridge pipeline, the proposed Enbridge pipeline, which was a bitumen pipeline. And then after that, there was the Pacific Trails pipeline, which is a fracked gas pipeline. And now we have Coastal GasLink. And so we know from other agreements that we've seen that the people that have signed on to these pipelines have agreed that they would be open to an energy corridor. And so we know that if one pipeline is approved and goes through, then more will follow. And we heard rumblings a couple of months ago that the Pacific Trails pipeline, which had previously lost investments and so didn't proceed, were trying to get investors again because they thought that Coastal GasLink was going to go through and then that would mitigate their right-of-way to be able to put the Pacific Trails pipeline through. But yeah, there's definitely other proposed pipelines that have tried in the past, and so that's why we need to be adamant in our stance and our jurisdiction over our territories, because one pipeline would be devastating to our territories and multiple pipelines would make it a complete wasteland.
In the reporting on this, it's been pretty clear that the corporate media is taking advantage of widespread ignorance among settlers about the difference between the hereditary and the band council chiefs.
Mm-hmm.
For people who've been reading mainstream media sources about this struggle, what do you think they need to know about these things?
So the hereditary system, which has been governing our people for millennia, has proven in the highest courts in Canada, the Supreme Court of Canada, that it's our hereditary chiefs that have jurisdiction over our territory. And the imposed Indian Act Chief and Council, which is the band system, only has jurisdiction over the reserves, and they were put in place as a way to manage things like housing and water, sort of the everyday logistics of people being forced to live on the reserve. So that governance system was something that was imposed on our people. They have never been given jurisdiction to speak on behalf of our entire territory. That has been proven time and time again through the court system that it is our traditional system that has jurisdiction.
Yeah, and so, you know, this struggle has been going on for a long time. Can you talk a bit about some of the legal avenues that the chiefs turned to back in the 80s and the 90s?
So the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs, along with the Gitxsan hereditary chiefs, took their case to the courts. And originally, the decision was against them in the BC Supreme Court. And so they appealed it and took it to the Supreme Court of Canada. And they won that court case in 1997. And the big takeaway from that court case was that our oral histories were admissible in court. So previous to that, no Indigenous oral histories were admissible as evidence. And so that was one win that came out of that court case. And the other one, the important one in this struggle right now, is that the Wet'suwet'en and Gitxsan hereditary chiefs had never ceded their title. So they maintained their title and jurisdiction over their territories. And for the Wet'suwet'en, that's 22,000 square kilometers.
So moving back to the present moment, you know, what's going on in that territory, in January, the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs issued an eviction notice to Coastal GasLink, and the RCMP invaded Wet'suwet'en territory soon after, you know, raiding the camps, arresting multiple people. And this came almost exactly a year after the RCMP's last raid to facilitate Coastal GasLink workers entering the territory. What has the impact of these raids been, you know, of having RCMP and Coastal GasLink on your territory?
The last year has been really, really devastating for our communities and for our people that are out on the territory. They suffered daily harassment and intimidation by the RCMP. After the raid last year, after January 7th of 2018, we actually had Coastal GasLink security, private security, threatening to arrest people that were on the road. My sister would be in her home out on the territory, and she would wake up in the morning and there was RCMP parked at the end of her driveway. She was constantly threatened with arrest. People that were out on our territory, our guests as well as our membership, were constantly harassed by RCMP, pulled over for no reason, having their vehicles towed, being threatened with arrest. It was just nonstop. People would be going out to harvest medicines or pick berries, and they would have RCMP or CGL security follow them, park there, and watch them and harass them while we were conducting our traditional activities out on the land. There have been really huge impacts to our wildlife, so our moose populations, our grizzly bear habitat, the destruction and desecration of our cultural sites, one of them being the Queese War Trail that they have bulldozed over. There have been artifacts found at the Camp 9A site, which is where they have their proposed man camp site. They have bulldozed through active trap lines and prevented people from going and checking their traps, which means that there could have been animals suffering in those traps. They went in and bulldozed our Gidimdan camp, and the police facilitated that. There's currently a civil court case going on for the destruction of private property. The list just goes on and on of the things that we have had to endure and deal with, you know, during that 1 year in between the two raids. It's just been an ongoing assault on our people. Like, the raid didn't end on January 7th of last year. It continued.
So recently it made headlines that the RCMP had authorized lethal overwatch during the raid last year, which means that they're prepared to kill people. Can you put this into context for listeners who have maybe never heard of the RCMP?
So the RCMP were established in Canada as a police force specifically designed to manage the First Nations population. So they were the ones who were sent out and forced our people off of their territories where they were living and forced them onto reserves. The RCMP were the ones who went and stole all of the children and sent them to residential schools. They historically and currently will assist in the theft of our children through the Ministry of Children and Family Development. And now, of course, we're seeing them fulfilling that historic role in escorting industry into our territories as well. So the entire history of the RCMP is built around access to our land and our resources.
So I've noticed that both the government and also corporate media have been really actively obscuring the demands that the Wet'suwet'en chiefs have made very clear. Can you clarify what these are, especially given this misinformation campaign?
So the hereditary chiefs have been adamant that they are not willing to have nation-to-nation discussions while under a gun. And so they are asking very clearly to the government to have the RCMP detachment at 29 kilometer removed from our territory. And the SIRG, which are the E division of the RCMP, cease patrols on our territory so that we can have free and open conversations with the government. You can't enter into any discussions in good faith while our people are under constant threat of the RCMP. The other condition that they have asked for is that Coastal GasLink stop work while we're having these nation-to-nation discussions. You know, legal precedent shows that if there is title established, then any project that is currently on their territory, they will have to go back and have free, prior, and informed consent. And the province has already agreed to have these discussions with us about how we are going to implement our rights and title. But they have already approved this project, knowing that we demand free, prior, and informed consent for any project in our territory. And the province of British Columbia has already adopted UNDRIP, which is the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which very clearly states that any project within our territories requires free, prior, and informed consent. So the province is saying one thing and acting in a completely opposite way.
So after the RCMP incursion and the government's failure to meet the demands, a call for solidarity came from the Unist'ot'en and Gidendam camp to shut down Canada. When the call first went out, did you have any sense of the uprising that was going to emerge?
No. The response from Indigenous people and settler people all across so-called Canada has been overwhelming and humbling and inspiring. I don't think any of us realized how much support was actually out there until this happened. I know that it was really eye-opening for our hereditary chiefs when we took our recent trip out to Mohawk territory in Tiendanega and Kahnawake to see the kind of support and solidarity that was happening all across the country, and to meet the people on the ground and to shake their hands and thank them for what they're doing. We definitely wouldn't be in the position that we are right now if it wasn't for our allies like the Mohawks that are standing up, and the youth, the Indigenous youth all across Canada that are using their voices for their future and that are taking a stand and fighting back against the government, who is clearly not following their own laws and their own legal precedents. It's really, I feel like, a huge sense of relief in knowing that other people care and understand how much we've been going through and are willing to back us up and stand with us and educate themselves and their peers and their communities. You know, it feels like we've been doing this for so long on our own, and I know that Unistoten has been doing it for a lot longer. And it's difficult when you're in an isolated community like we are to get the message that people are out there and they're standing with us and they're risking their own freedom, because they understand that what happens to one of us happens to all of us. And that's really encouraging. And I think that it's really empowering for hereditary chiefs to see that and to see people out on the front lines and saying, you can't push these people around. You can't force them off of their territories. You can't force a project through. We have sovereignty and we have jurisdiction. And to know that that message is being heard and being supported is really, it's kind of surreal to be sitting here in Smithers, seeing all the actions that are taking place and people supporting us.
Yeah, I mean, the Shutdown Canada actions that are happening faster than I can even keep track of, in a lot of ways, it sort of seems unprecedented. And I'm wondering what histories of resistance are at the front of your mind as you're watching this all unfold.
Oh my God, I haven't had much time to think. certainly, we have a history of resistance in Canada, and definitely things like OCA come to mind, Gustafson Lake come to mind, and current resistance is happening as well. You know, the Tsleil-Waututh people in Blue River, you know, with the Tiny House Warriors, and even in the north here, you know, we've seen more recent resistance to industry, such as the Tahltan people and the Shell project, and resistances in Haida Gwaii to logging and on the coast with the fish farms. And, you know, this isn't a new fight for Indigenous people. This has been ongoing since contact. And we know that this has been like the main drive for Canada to displace us and dispossess us of our land so that they can have access to our resources. This isn't new. This has been something that's been going on ever since contact first happened. And so for a lot of these people and a lot of these communities, I think everything just came together in the perfect way for people to unite and stand together. And every Indigenous person across Turtle Island knows what it is that we're feeling and what we're going through. So, yeah, I guess on one hand, I'm not surprised. The thing that is surprising is the unity of actions that are happening. It's overwhelming, and I get really emotional when I talk about it, because I know that there are people that are out there taking time away from their families, from their jobs, from their children, and are doing that all in support of the fight that we are in, because they recognize that we're all connected. And that means a lot.
And on that note of solidarity, this uprising is ongoing. It seems like every few hours there's a new development and a new solidarity action. If people want to keep up on what's happening and get involved, what's the best way for them to do that?
So on our Facebook page, we have an ongoing event. It's pinned to the top of our page, and people can comment or message with their solidarity events, and it will be added to the description of the event so that other people can go and look and see if there's something happening in their community. And the solidarity events are a really important piece. It's keeping the pressure on the government to do the right thing. It's also a good way to educate the broader community about what's happening. And I always want to encourage other Indigenous people to start enforcing their laws and reoccupying their territories. And for allies and settlers, I think it's really important to support those actions wherever it is that you are. So if you're living in Anishinaabe territory or Mohawk territory or Coast Salish territory, Suquamish territory, building those relationships is going to be really key, because this is a turning point in our history, and we need all our Indigenous people to be able to implement their jurisdiction on their lands.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. I know that you are incredibly busy, and David and I are both really grateful for the time that you've just taken.
You bet.
Trafe Podcast is Sam Bick and David Zinman. A huge thanks to CKUT 90.3 FM, where we record this podcast under the shadow of the giant cross of secularism on occupied Gunyagahaga territory.
Thanks as always to Sack Syndrome and So-Called for the music you heard in the episode, and to everybody who helps make Trafe Podcast happen.
You can check us out on the social medias at Trafe, T-R-E-Y-F, on Twitter, on Facebook, and on Instagram.
Please send any comments, suggestions, or hate mail to trafepodcast@gmail.com.
More episodes soon. Hey, everyone.
Hello, hello. Shalom, bonjour, Sam.
Hi, David. What's up?
Sitting inside my apartment on this rainy day.
Yeah, it's very unpleasant outside.
But I'm glad to say that we're here with a new installment of our In the Streets series.
Specifically, an In the Streets, which features an interview with Skylar Williams, who's a spokesperson for 1492 Lineback Lane.
And 1492 Lineback Lane is a land reclamation project that's taking place at Six Nations right now. Folks have been occupying the site there for about 3 months, defending their territory from a planned settler housing development.
Yeah, and Six Nations, you know, it's just about an hour drive west from Toronto. And while it's the most populated reserve in so-called Canada, it's been severely reduced in size by ongoing land theft and settlement.
And so on October 9th, there is a big multi-city day of action that took place in solidarity with the ongoing land defense effort going on there.
And just after this mobilization, David was able to chat with Skylar about the struggle that's going on.
Yeah. And, you know, just to note that the audio quality is unfortunately not great, you know, just a limitation of the situation right now. But if you have trouble hearing any part of the conversation, we have a link to a full transcript in the show notes.
And just an update that since this conversation a few days ago, unfortunately, several more people have been arrested by the Ontario Provincial Police, including Tani Williams, who's married to Skylar.
And without further ado, here is our conversation with Skylar Williams. Hey, Skylar, can you hear me?
I can.
Great. Thanks for bearing with me with this weird technical situation.
I am yours for at least an hour.
Okay, great. So if you want to just say your name and then a bit about who you are, we can just take it from there.
Sure. All right. Hi, everybody. I'm Skylar Williams from Six Nations, Grand River. We've been hanging out at 1492 Lineback Lane now, where today is day number 87. Okay, 87, yep.
Well, Skylar, thanks for coming on the show. It's great to be talking with you.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
So I have a lot of questions. Obviously, we want to talk about 1492 Lineback Lane and the land reclamation project that's happening right now on Six Nations territory. But to start off, just for folks who aren't familiar with the struggle, who maybe aren't familiar with Six Nations, can you maybe give some background on what the Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve is?
So yeah, so the Six Nations itself, as it sits today anyways, is about a 12 by 14 kilometer square, kind of smack dab in the middle of southern Ontario. It's about 20 minutes south of Hamilton. It used to be, from the mouth to the source of the Grand River, which is about 200 miles long, 6 miles on either side of that river, and has been slowly eroded away by squatters and fraudulent land deals over the last 150 years or so. And so that's kind of where we're at right now, is this kind of small 10 by 12 little kilometers square postage stamp in the middle of southern Ontario. It is the most populated reserve, not just in Canada, but in North America.
And, you know, I think it's probably important to also say that what's happening right now is certainly not the first struggle like this to happen at Six Nations. You know, in 2006, there was a protracted land defense struggle against the Douglas Creek Estates housing development that was planned for Six Nations territory. You know, a struggle that you were part of and led to the successful land reclamation of what's now known as Gunnestado. You know, for people who are unfamiliar with this history, can you tell us a bit about what happened back in 2006?
Yeah, there was a development that rolled up right on the, like, that bordered the reserve that was going to see about 1,000 houses built, like, right on our doorstep. And there was lots and lots of documentation about whose land it was and how it was squatted on and how all of the fraudulent dealings of, you know, the last 150 years had got it to the point where we are kind of hemmed into this little reserve. And so there was a group of women there that kind of banded together and wanted to share some information about, you know, whose land it was that people were developing on. And so they had went in and were handing out pamphlets and flyers to people, letting people understand and know what was happening. In the process of this, they had been confronted by some of the people that were working at the site there. Some of the workers kind of confronted some of the women there, and there was a load of gravel that was poured at their feet from a dump truck. And so then myself and some of the guys from Six Nations here came out, and people from all over Turtle Island came out to come and lend a hand and support. And it didn't start out that way, but it became a land reclamation, and we took back our land. And it's been 14 and a half years now, and our people are still occupying that land today.
And, you know, looking back at that process of reclaiming that territory, what did that struggle look like, and how does it compare to what's going on right now?
Well, I mean, it was just about occupation. And just like it is today, it was peaceful and remained peaceful from the very start till right now. The only days that there was ever violence that was coming to anybody there was when the OPP raided. And at that time, they raided with 220 OPP officers, snipers in trees. There's lots of emergency response team unit members that were, like, full military gear, tear gas canister guns, like, the whole works. And so they raided April 20th, 2006. I wasn't arrested that day, but I spent about a year in the bush there. And eventually after that, I was charged for several crimes and spent 7 months in jail. And then at my trial, all the charges were dropped and thrown out, and I was released. And so, yeah, there was quite a bit of police violence that was happening. And so, you know, lots of people did defend themselves. And for myself, I had half a dozen counts of resisting arrest and assaulting police officers. And there was lots of that. But because they were all deemed illegal arrests at the time, all my charges were subsequently dropped.
And, you know, something else that stands out to me looking back at that 2006 struggle is sort of the high level of white settler backlash that was going on at that time. You know, I remember Gary McHale's attempts at organizing a white militia in response to the land reclamation, you know, saying that the police weren't going far enough.
There were lots of that. And, like, the, what was it, the Aryan Brotherhood had come down at one point to make their voices known. And there was lots and lots of racist rhetoric that was kind of being floated around by lots of people like that. There were some moments of engagement with them that turned violent, and it was certainly an interesting time when Gary McHale came to town.
Yeah, and you know, in some ways it seems like that, you know, sort of reactionary settler violence continued forward. You know, I remember in 2012, I think it was the day after one of Gary McHale's rallies, there was a settler car attack. It drove into the area that had been reclaimed. But today it seems like that settler backlash is being led more explicitly by politicians, you know, whether it's Ontario Premier Doug Ford or Haldimand Mayor Ken Hewitt. Does it feel like that backlash is materializing differently this time?
Yeah, there hasn't been any kind of in-your-face racism from people who aren't politicians, although I do get quite a bit of death threats on a daily basis. And those generally spike around those moments when these politicians are talking in the media to say that, you know, we're terrorists and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, when politicians throw around words like that, it inflames some of the far-right community that feels like they need to get some settler justice, you know?
Right. And, you know, whether it's happening among the far-right and their media or even more mainstream media outlets, something that we saw happen during the Shutdown Canada mobilization was the strategy that really took advantage of widespread settler ignorance, you know, in that case, between the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs and the band council system imposed by Canada. you know, for those who aren't familiar with the context, what do you think people need to know about the differences between the Haudenosaunee Confederacy Chiefs Council and the Six Nations Band Council?
In 1924, an Indian Act government was put in at Six Nations, and it had been something that was taking a foothold in Native communities across the country at the time. And so part of that Indian Act system was lots and lots of rules that governed Indigenous folks, including the rule that we weren't allowed to hire a lawyer to defend ourselves in court, and if a lawyer did do it, they'd be disbarred. So yeah, there was 1924, the RCMP rolled in and started making arrests of some of our hereditary chiefs that, you know, were protesting that. At the time, one of our chiefs, this guy, made a trip to the UN to try and plead our case there, for which then he was barred from re-entering the country under the rules under treason. And he spent the remainder of his life, last 25 years of his life, in upstate New York. And so, like, our people have been fighting against that band council system since before its inception. So after the RCMP rolled in and arrested everybody, band council system was enacted here. Our people today, fast forward 100 years, the last voter turnout that we just had, the percentage of possible voters, was the biggest in Six Nations had ever seen. And that's 4.2% of the possible voters turn out to vote. The hereditary chiefs have, you know, maintained their government for most conservative estimates, put it at about 1,000 years old, 1,200 years old. Some of the more less conservative estimates put it quite a bit older than that. And so this is at least a 1,200-year-old democracy that has been working in this continent for the last at least 1,200 years. And so for us, if I was going to tell my mom or dad that I was going to vote in the election, they'd probably disown me. It's, you know, like, this is participating in the oppression of our people. And so this is something that certainly my family and lots of people like me, 96% of our community feels that that's not their system that represents them. We have a lot more than 4% voter turnout.
Right. And so moving back to the present moment, can you talk a bit about the site that's become known as 1492 Lambeck Lane? Like, how did things first get started?
It was some friends and I were talking one day and had been involved in other things in the past, and we had heard about this other development that was rolling up. And the thing is that the 2006 reclamation that we were just talking about, this particular development is going to roll up right to the front door of that development, directly across the road. And so, like, for people like myself that spent a lot of time in the bush there and, you know, a good chunk of time in jail for it, we saw that as a big slap in the face to the efforts that we had made previous. So, and then we had done all of our research that we needed to do and found out all of the land deals that happened to make that particular tract of land kind of follow the paperwork along, and felt like we had a proper claim over the land there. And then COVID happened. And so we kind of got sidelined by that for several months. But during that time, development rolled on. Bulldozers were working, and as soon as COVID stuff started to lessen, I know it's tightening again, but as soon as it started to lessen a bit, we said, all right, it's time. And on July 19th, we gathered our friends and family, and there was about 20 of us on the first day, a dozen cars, and we just rolled right in the front door of Lambeck Lane, and we wanted to make things as peaceful and as unconfrontational as we possibly could. You know, we were being very deliberate about the way that we did things. And so moving in there on a Sunday evening, we wanted to make sure that there was going to be no developers we were going to be confronting. And so when we got there, we were there for about an hour. We sat down, we made a fire, we put up some flags, and we sat down, we ate dinner together, laughed and joked. And about an hour later, the cops rolled in. A couple of OPP cruisers rolled in. They asked how long we were planning on being there. And I said, well, my people have been here for the last 10,000 years. I think we're probably going to be here for 10,000 more. They said, oh, so, well, your friends, you're going to be here for a while? Yeah, we're probably going to be here for a while. Yeah, and then they left, and that was the first day. And then we camped out that night, and we've been camped out there now, almost 90 days. About 3 months we've been there now.
And it seems like a big turning point happened on August 5th when the OPP raided the site. Can you talk a bit about what happened that day?
There had been some injunction stuff that the developer was pushing for. Finally, on August 5th, the developer got the injunction, and the police were ready to enforce that injunction. The cops came in, shooting rubber bullets, grabbing people, tasering people. One guy got knee in the back of his neck, and getting dragged along the pavement, set some scars on his face because of it. And one guy got tased in the neck and head. I had rubber bullets whizzing by my ears. There was myself and eight other people that were arrested that day. But when I got out of jail that day, this woman came running up to me with a phone and showed me a video, live feed video of somebody on Facebook or Twitter or something, of a bunch of fires on the highway, fires on the train tracks, fires on Argyle Street, and people pushing a cop back. And so there was lots and lots and lots of stuff that was going on. In my absence while I was dealing with being locked up.
Yeah, I mean, like, blockades were set up to prevent the police from entering the territory. There was a secondary support camp that was established. You know, construction equipment was set on fire. Can you talk a bit about that support that manifested after the raid?
Yeah, I mean, there was lots of barricades that were set up across Highway 6, train tracks that kind of border our reserve. Road that kind of connects the back of our camp, like a dirt trail. It's kind of the back entrance for us to get into the camp. And so all of these kind of ways were cut off from people getting onto the site there at Landback Lane. And hundreds of people came out from Six Nations and surrounding communities to voice their displeasure with what was happening. And as much as I'm not a big fan of setting tires on fire and barricades and all that stuff, after, 400 years of hate and anger and over-incarceration of Indigenous people, residential school, like, all of that history of violence that's been predicated on Indian people, when that racism is something that is whispered behind people's backs in their own quiet corners, it's almost tolerable for people. But when that racism is so in your face that the cops are coming into people occupying their own land, and they're being shot at and tasered and beaten and dragged off of their land, that kind of racism is so in your face that it brings up all of that quiet racism that we've dealt with and are dealing with every day. And so when I got no blame for anybody who set a tire on fire that day or flipped a car over in the middle of the road or burnt an excavator or anything that anybody did that day, I had no blame whatsoever. And I certainly don't have any judgment for it, because this is what the state is planning on doing to Indigenous people who stand up for their rights. This is what you can expect when you've been alienated from the system, an entire race of people, and certainly a community as big, as vast, as diverse as Six Nations is, and you inflame that situation like that. How can you expect a different result than people coming out and voicing that frustration and that anger towards a system that has seen them jailed beyond words, that have seen them shot and killed by police violence? It's absolutely ridiculous to think that there would have been any kind of other result other than what happened.
Yeah, and it seems like that support that materialized after the raid has been an important factor in preventing another police raid of the site, or at least for now. And that support has continued to build in different ways. You know, we got to see it across multiple cities a few days ago. On October 9th, there was a call for a day of action in solidarity with 1492 Landback Lane. What did that day mean for folks who were at the site at the time?
Yeah, I mean, that day coincided for us with our last court hearing, which was the injunction hearing, where the judge was supposed to be ruling on whether or not there would be a permanent injunction on the land there that would have this Superior Court judge in Haldimand County, Ontario, be able to take it upon himself to extinguish all land claims over that, and at the same time not allow me to speak in my defense. And so, yeah, to see actions in Vancouver and Winnipeg and Saskatchewan, Montreal, Toronto, Guelph, Cambridge, Nova Scotia, like, it was every city, lots of reserves came out in huge, huge ways. And there's a huge team that has held it down now for like almost 3 months at Landback Lane, And like, I cannot say enough about the women that have spearheaded this movement and are the ones pushing us through all of the hard times and the good times and the everyday times that are just, like, these women have managed to hold it down in a way. And, you know, we're a matrilineal society here. And we really hold our women very, very high esteem and make sure that we take their direction and their guidance very, very seriously. And so these women have held it down in ways that I've never seen before. And it's an amazing thing to be a part of that.
Right. And, you know, as folks continue to hold things down at the site and as all this support is building, repression is continuing. You know, instead of doing another raid, the police have been going to the homes of people who they believe have been on the site and, you know, arresting them, charging people, putting warrants out for people's arrests. How many people have received charges at this point?
So right now, I think it's 32 total. And people have been getting calls, my wife included. People have been just calling them at home. And, you know, for a lot of people that, you know, have jobs and have kids, they can't have a warrant for them, you know, not have it dealt with. And so they have to turn themselves in, or OPP have been showing up at their home. And one guy got arrested, pulled over on the side of the road by several police cruisers and dragged out of the car in front of his kid. One girl went to her grandmother's funeral in the States, and when she came back across the border with her four children, was hauled in and arrested at the border. And so, yeah, it's pretty consistent criminalization of our land defenders.
And what was the result of that court hearing that happened on October 9th as all the support actions were taking place? You know, where are things at right now in terms of the legal attack on the folks defending the territory?
So right now, the judge did not make a ruling whatsoever on the injunction stuff. What he said in his judgment, that we need to leave the land, and if I'm going to be able to defend myself, because I am the only named party in it, I need to be off the land. But not only am I responsible only for my actions, but I need to make everybody else that came there with me, I have to make them leave as well. And he said that Six Nations had never made a claim over that land before through the court or through government. And just so, you know, your listeners can know, I mean, it was about 1820 that our people here at Six Nations started asking the government and petitioning government to remove squatters from our land. And so we did that consistently from 1820 till about 1920. After 1920, residential school had really taken a foothold. The Indian Act was being implemented. After 1921, we were no longer allowed to hire a lawyer, and that stayed that way until the mid-50s. After 1950, the 60s scoop happened, and so then it was dealing with the trauma and aftermath of, like, my dad will tell stories of, you know, hiding in the bush during the 60s while he was on his way to school, because the church would come out and snatch kids on their way to school to take them to the residential school. It wasn't exactly the ideal moment for us as a people to be able to push forward with any kind of land claims issue, because you didn't know whether or not you were going to have kids to feed or means to, and there was a pass system for leaving the reserve. You had to go and talk to the Indian agent to get your pass to leave the reservation to go to the grocery store. Like, it was, you could not be in the same house with five people that were not your family members. Like, there was lots and lots of laws that kept us from being able to do any of this kind of stuff prior to the last 15 years. And so 15 years ago, the Douglas Creek Estates, Conestado now, that happened, and that kind of lit a fire into everybody that said, like, you know what, it's time that our voices be heard again. It is absolutely time, and, like, the system has been built and designed in a way that sees Indigenous people alienated from that process, and we're saying, you know what, no more. And this particular judge who's really, really doesn't like me very much is, and we got to remember that the Haldeman County Court is literally a stone's throw from the river. If you could walk out the back door of the courthouse, throw a stone, and it would splash into the water. So, like, to say that they don't have bias, that the court that is making the judgment is actually sitting on uncontested land. And so it's really hard for a lot of folks, certainly from Six Nations, to sit idly by while this stuff is happening.
And so following that court hearing, is there still technically a warrant out for your arrest?
Oh, there's no technically about it. No, there is fully a warrant for my arrest, yeah.
And so what does that mean for you right now?
Well, it means I'm not going to the grocery store anytime soon. But at the same time, like, I'm not hiding. Lived in my home for, you know, the last 10 years, and I'm not going to hide from anybody. I mean, for the last 3 months, I've lived down at Landau Lane, but I go home every couple of days, have a shower, and wash my clothes, and see my kids, and, you know, make sure my pigs and goats and chickens are all fed, and I live on a farm, and, like, yeah, so I'm not hiding from anybody, and, yeah.
So, you know, as the struggle is now continuing into the colder weather, and folks are making plans for the winter, are there any parts of that struggle from 2006 that are sort of in the back of your mind right now?
Sure. There's lots and lots of things that are, you know, that are very similar, and that are, you know, some of the people, some of the good times and the happy and the laughing and the stories, and our people like to sing and dance and laugh and do all the things that we do as Ngohowe people, and it's certainly those bits anyways are quite refreshing to be able to kind of be a part of that. And so yeah, there are lots of similarities.
And what are things like at the site right now? Like how are spirits considering everything that's going on?
I mean, they ebb and flow. I mean, the spirits right now are good, you know, like everybody is mostly the same as what they have been, which is sitting around the fire and cutting wood, and there's always camp maintenance that's happening. We got a building that's going on. There's lots of people working on the law stuff and trying to support all the people that are being charged criminally. And so we've been doing lots to make sure that we're able to keep pushing forward with all of the things that we need to do in order to maintain our presence throughout the winter.
And I know that there's both a building fund and a legal fund to help that work continue. If people are able to donate to either of those, we're going to have links in the show notes. But is there anything you think people should know about the need for funds right now?
Yeah, so like the number of warrants that are out right now, I think was at 22, as well as the 30 that have already been arrested. So the criminal defense stuff is huge. And in order for us to be able to win at this, we need to be able to stay there and occupy our land. And so we've got both going. So the criminal defense stuff, you can find on GoFundMe. Just look up 1492 Landback Lane. And for the camp and the build fund, so we use that money for, you know, building and, you know, gas for the generators. We would not be able to do the work that we're doing without the, you know, generous support of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that have pushed us to this point right now.
Well, Skylar, thank you so much for taking this time to chat. I know things are pretty hectic out there right now, so I really appreciate it. And you know, sending our solidarity from all of us out here.
Right on. I appreciate that very much. It's gonna all be Kadash.
Trafe Podcast is Sam Bick and David Zinman. A huge thanks to CQT 90.3 FM, where we normally record this podcast, under the shadow of the giant cross of secularism on occupied Ganyagahaga territory.
Thanks, as always, to Sack Syndrome and So-Called for the music you heard in the episode, and to everybody who helps make Trafe Podcast happen.
You can also follow us on all the social medias at Trafe, T-R-E-Y-F. That includes Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And you can also visit our shiny website, trafepodcast.com.
And you can send us comments, suggestions, or hate mail to trafepodcast@gmail.com.
More episodes soon.
Plus que jamais, la santé de tous est entre nos mains. Sur mon cellulaire, l'application Alerte COVID m'avise si j'ai été en contact avec une personne déclarée positive récemment. Du bout des doigts et dans le respect de ma vie privée, je peux protéger ma santé et celle de mes proches simplement en téléchargeant l'application Alerte COVID. Rendez-vous dès maintenant sur québec.ca/alerte-covid pour obtenir plus...
Can she tell me? Respond and tell me rough. Want it rough. She want it rough. Can me love it when you want, shake it up for me. Tell your body a designer, your body fit it. Me not like, get your body ready. Put you up in my life, get me ready, baby. Put you up in my ride, anyway you're ready. She say she have a man, but the man already. She tell me the man a beat her, in my ill treat her. She tell me she want some rough. Yeah, in the middle of the night, say she want some. She whisper in my ears and I tell me the whole night, say she want rough.